Take a network break. We're pleased to announce that Virtual Donuts have just acquired Virtual Eclairs. The acquisition will extend our leadership in the cream-filled baked goods vertical and position us for accelerated growth as we drive the digital transformation of the snack industry. On today's show, we'll discuss big news from Extreme Networks, new products from Mist, a significant outage, and more tech news. First, a little business. Our sponsor today is Thousand Eyes. They give you performance visibility from every user to every app over any network, both internal and external, so you can migrate to the cloud, troubleshoot faster, and deliver exceptional user experience. Sign up for a free account at thousandeyes.com/packetpushers and choose a free Thousand Eyes t-shirt. And stay tuned after the news. We've got a sponsored Tech Bytes episode with Anuta Networks. They make network automation software for multi-vendor environments, and we're going to talk about Anuta's capabilities, including low-code automation, network device configurations, compliance checks, telemetry collection, and more. All right, before we get to the news, we have a couple of FUs.
Ah, so much feedback. It's been awesome. We've had so many people coming back to us and saying things, and I've just sort of a little overwhelmed. So if I haven't gotten back to you yet, I apologize. I am trying to get back to everybody. There's been a lot of things happening this week that require a lot of things. Our first piece of FU is from Patrick Swackhammer. He's a longtime follower of the show. We talked about using light last week as a networking. We had the light sources in the house inside of corporate buildings, and he just wrote in to point out that in the spirit of RFC 1925, Rule 11, which is there's nothing new in networking, the same ideas keep coming around again. He points out that the original IEEE 802.11 standard back in the old days had a frequency hopping spread spectrum, a direct sequence spread spectrum, and an infrared wireless networking standard all the way back then. So he points out, not surprised to see that light has bounced back.
There's nothing new under the sun, as they say.
Yeah. So it's just a really good pickup, though. Infrared, or as they call it, free space optics these days, because infrared's a bit tedious.
Free space optics name. Is way sexier.
Yeah, just a very interesting way of looking at it. But yeah, good idea. Good catch. Yeah, nice work, Patrick.
We also got a note from Paul Van Horn about comments we made around Aruba and their relationship with HPE.
Yes, and I think you sort of missed my point, Paul. I hope this is okay, but I know that Aruba is a HPE company. My point is that it's not HPE Aruba. In the same way that Cisco Meraki is called Cisco Meraki, it's not Meraki, a Cisco company. It's Cisco Meraki, and it's a product family, although it's held at arm's length. Aruba seems to want to hold itself further away from the core business than would reasonably be expected or would normally be expected. No, I don't have a problem with it. I'm just highlighting that it's unusual that it's not HPE Aruba like Cisco Meraki is. It's Aruba, a HPE company. And there doesn't seem to be any other business units that I've seen yet. I could be wrong. Haven't noticed any other business units being a HPE company. I just find that unusual so long after the acquisition.
Yeah, maybe something about Aruba's culture.
Yeah, something's happening there. I don't really want to dig into what and where or why that would be. I'd need to sit down and think about it before I made any comments. But that's, yes, I agree. I'm aware that Aruba is a HPE company, not HPE Aruba.
And also an FU around internships and mentoring.
So I made the commentary about certifications a couple of shows ago. Lots of pushback on that. A lot of people seemed to be hearing what they wanted to hear. So as I followed up with an article over on Ethereal Mind, which seems to have even further upset at a bunch of people, which is okay. I am being a little provocative here and trying to get people to think past their certifications and say to you, you need to be better. But Rob wrote in and said, I've had the opportunity to mentor 5 or 6 interns from college programs. I really enjoy mentoring others and seeing them develop. And each of these, I found they needed more mentorship than those with certifications such as CCNA, CMP, and they're better engineers and take less time to mentor specifically in their practical ability to solve problems outside the box. Now, there's a whole bunch of questions that would be taken away from that. People with certifications will be more immediately useful. That is, they'll not need as much mentoring to get started off the ground and start to be useful. That's certainly what those programs are designed to do. My point is, achieving those certifications will only take you so far. It's a beginning point. It's the first step in a lifelong career of learning. Enterprise IT jobs are cushy jobs. You work in a lovely warm building. You have clean hands. People give you fancy ergonomic seats. By and large, if you're a networking professional, you sit around and do nothing most of the day because nobody knows what you do, so they can't really monitor you. It's a cushy job, and you get paid really substantial salaries for not a whole lot of work. So my point is, your certification is a starting point. It's not an end point. Just because you passed your cert means you've now finished your apprenticeship and you might be ready to move on to being a tradesman. And so, yes, I agree with you. Very likely, picking out people who've got CCNP would be more useful to you. And sometimes it's down to the person involved. But yes, on that balance, appreciate the feedback. I'd like to extend that conversation into something a bit larger.
We also had an FU for last week's network break where we talked about Helium. This is a startup doing a local or sort of a mesh IoT network that's they're positioning as sort of thwarting the big Verizon.
I can see that the word blockchain just instantly shuts your brain down.
Yes, and it's got something to do with blockchain. And so, but we got some follow-up on that.
Yeah, so Josh from ImageStream, he has actually been working on what's called these low-powered WAN solutions, so LoRa, LPWAN, NB-IoT, those types of technologies. And he wanted to highlight that the thing that I missed out was LoRa. Now, LoRa was a technology that, again, using the low-frequency spectrum, very long distances, gets a few miles away from an antenna. And you don't actually need that many base stations. The problem with smartphones is you actually need to be quite close to a smartphone tower to be able to get data flowing along those pipes and so forth. And as he says, low-powered WANs is rather interesting bits of tech. It's really kind of cool seeing data come in from a small device that's 500 meters away with an RSSI of minus 139 dBm. That's a really weak signal, basically. And it is rather slow, bits to kilobits per second, but for IoT applications, that's more than fast enough. He just sort of, the rest of his commentary was that it's pretty odd that you need a blockchain to do what Helium's doing when LoRa and LPWAN is going to be coming out to normal telcos, which is something like what I talked about. So I'll look forward to, hopefully Josh can tell me what his experiences of getting a low-powered WAN solution up in association with his day job.
Yeah, there's also something that he referenced called the Things Network, which sounds like it's doing something similar to Helium, but without the blockchain element.
Yeah.
All right, let's get into the news. But thank you, everyone, for the FUs. Whether you want to give us a correction or elucidate something we said or embrace and extend a conversation we had, we always welcome follow-up.
Especially when we're wrong, want to be able to correct when we're wrong so that you know, and also have a conversation. Hearing from you, telling us stories, giving me more input helps us to be better at this. So please do get in contact. Email us, packetpushers@gmail.com. Love to hear your follow-up. And telling us the FU is the best way for us to get forward.
Right, moving on to the news. The big story for the week, Extreme Networks has acquired or will acquire Aerohive, continuing its growth through acquisition strategy. The company is paying $227 million to purchase Aerohive Networks. They have a cloud-managed WLAN offering. Greg, Extreme already has a Wi-Fi portfolio from Anterisys and Zebra. Why go to Aerohive?
In this case, it's because Aerohive has a cloud platform. So Zebra and Anterisys were the traditional Wi-Fi approaches, on-prem, yeah. Wi-Fi controllers, mm-hmm. that sort of stuff. And as you would well be aware by now, the latest business fashion is to be cloud and subscription revenue, right? So I think that Extreme must have taken a close look at the existing products and decided, do we go and build a cloud platform for those or do we go and buy one? And I think the decision here came down to a buy decision.
Yeah, clearly.
So that's it.
That's it.
Kind of all done. No.
Analysis over. Thank you.
Yeah, Aerohive is really interesting. The whole purchase price was $272 million, but Aerohive's got 60-odd million in cash at the bank. Very well, tightly run, well-organized companies, always has been. So nominally, the price is $210 million. I suspect investors won't be overly happy. The share price has been largely static. The share price that sold at was basically been the same for the last 2 or 3 years. Its sales have completely stagnated. So Aerohive sales, it was a publicly listed company, so we can get some insights into what's actually happening there. And we can see that their sales have been static for quite a long time. I think combining Aerohive with Extreme lets Extreme go and pitch themselves against Meraki. So this becomes a small business, small branch alternative at a modest cost, that branch edge thing that Meraki has proven that customers really want.
Yeah, when I talked to Extreme about this, they said what they like about Aerohive is they have an SD branch play, which gives you some SD-WAN and also some branch management through switches and controllers and routers at the branch edge, and Extreme wants to get into that space. They also said that they like Aerohive's business model, which is subscription and recurring revenue. That Extreme is looking to mix up its revenue mix, and so Aerohive also gives them that option.
Yeah, I think the addition of an SD-WAN and a software-defined branch, they can start to do similar or better than Meraki, but not quite what Cisco's enterprise Wi-Fi solution is. So Cisco plus Meraki is just over half of the wireless market, which is odd, really. You don't sort of think of Cisco as having just half of that market. I thought it was more, but they obviously don't own it. The Aerohive owners shouldn't panic. It seems fairly clear from the presentation that Extreme wants to invest in this product and take it forward. I think if you've got the legacy, the existing wireless components, I think you might want to be getting some conversations going in the years ahead to see how long that lasts. I suspect Air or Hive will be the direction. It's possible that they will continue with the on-prem, you know, sealed in a box stuff, not with the cloud. Extreme is very big in the Fed market, mm-hmm. the FedRAMP education market in the US, and those people will struggle to pay for cloud. They want to buy it as a sealed unit. So possibly both products will go on. I think we'll just have to see how that plays out of time. You'll need to be talking to the sales reps and reading the tea leaves here. Against the background of a lot of Wi-Fi acquisitions. We saw Mist Wi-Fi was acquired by Juniper just a few months ago. Arista acquired Mojo. It leaves the question open, does Dell need one? Clearly Dell didn't participate here. Air or Hive would have been well suited to the Dell white box model. You know, we've got our in-house, but on white box, you can sell it by the white box if you want. But that seems to be the gap, is Dell doesn't have one.
Yes, and I was looking at the coverage I've done of AeroHive over the past year. They are coming to market. They, last year, or in 2018, announced A3. That's their NAC solution to compete with ICE and ClearPass from Cisco and Aruba. So they've got one of those, which we were talking about Arista and Mist. That's one of the things that Mist doesn't have. Juniper and Mist. They don't have a NAC solution. Yes. They're using partnerships. So AeroHive is coming to the table with that already. They're in SD-WAN, which I didn't know. But that is also part of a portfolio, I think, that Extreme was missing.
It's not an SD-WAN in the same way that there's a spectrum of SD-WAN, from simple IPsec failover. You know, they can do multiple links and they do the sort of configuration of the IPsec and sort out the connectivity part, to, you know, all the way up to where Silver Peak is, where they're doing WAN acceleration on SD-WAN with NFV and a whole bunch of third-party services, or CloudGenix with their cloud, you know, Blades thing, what we'll talk a little bit about later. It varies a lot.
It does vary a lot, and it seems like it's on the less feature-rich end of the spectrum, but at least it gives them a toehold in that market. Maybe seeing how Extreme is doing its business, it will go and pick up a full-fledged SD-WAN vendor down the line, but at least they can say at the moment, yes, we've got an SD-WAN solution if you're looking for it.
Just one commentary before we finish this up. Did you notice in the presentation they published a deck, and it keeps talking about how the two companies added together gets them over the $1 billion mark and drives a profit margin over 60%? I think they said it like four times in a 10-page deck.
They've been talking about being a billion-dollar company for a while now, or aiming to get there with all the acquisitions they did in the past. So I'm not surprised they highlighted that, yes.
Yeah, my inspirational cynicism knows says executive bonuses. I'm almost willing to bet a substantial part of buying this was the executives had we've got to get this company over $1 billion and 60% GP, and you get paid out handsomely. I'm pretty confident that AeroHive just delivered big time for those people.
I think that's a fair guess. Wouldn't be surprised with my own lens of cynicism. And also, it seems like in Silicon Valley, having that $1 billion number, you know, sort of ups your status in the community.
$1 billion. Yeah, I guess you can run around and go, oh, we got $1 billion worth of revenue, you know. But anyway, I think it's a good deal overall. I think it's good for AeroHive. One way I could rain on the parade here is just to point out that all of AeroHive software development and product development comes out of China. Although the head office is in Silicon Valley, all of its code work and everything is in China. And with a background of trade tensions between the two countries, there is the possibility for stuff going on there. I just wonder if that would cause any problems in the long term. But Extreme must have judged that as a reasonable risk going ahead.
All right. And also just to note, we saw some activity on social media about layoffs from Extreme. I haven't seen anything official from the company, but I don't know if this is connected with the acquisition.
My guess would be, and this is an outright guess, if you've got an AeroHive acquisition coming in, which is an SDM platform that's doing automation, and you've got another part of the business which is doing automation in other tools, you might want to wind down your existing automation and say our automation strategy is based around AeroHive. So, and if you are burning up cash buying a business, you might want to cut headcounts in other parts of the business just to make the numbers look a bit tighter for 2019 fin year. Okay. So bad luck to the people involved. I hope you find a place to land.
All right, moving on. A BGP route leak disrupted a noticeable chunk of internet traffic on the morning of June 24th when a regional ISP in Pennsylvania incorrectly advertised routes, which Verizon accepted and passed on. Traffic from companies such as Cloudflare, Amazon, and Facebook were pointed at this ISP and one of its customers. And of course, they couldn't handle the load, so they were overwhelmed. And chaos ensued.
Yeah, I thought it was a customer. I thought it was a big enterprise called Allegheny.
That's Allegheny Steel. It's a metals manufacturer in the Pittsburgh area, but it's connected to a regional ISP called DQE, I believe.
Ah, okay. So apparently Allegheny Steel owns a a BGP optimizer from Noxion, and part of their, and they must be connected to that ISP, which then connects up to the yes. Verizon backbone. The Allegheny Steel propagated some BGP routes from their BGP optimizer, which is used to, and the optimizer injects a bunch of specific routes. They're not supposed to leak past the boundary mm-hmm. into the backbone.
They did.
And at that point, large chunks of Verizon's backbone mm-hmm. was being poisoned with routes that prevented traffic from getting to Cloudflare, Amazon, Facebook, who all got very bent out of shape and started throwing a fair amount of shade around. And a certain number of the BGP errati, you know, the people who sort of manage all of this, started pointing fingers at various different things. And I'm sort of a bit sympathetic here. I recorded a podcast last night with Dave Temkin from Netflix, and I asked him about this issue in the show, and I'll publish in a few weeks. It'll be a Future of Network episode. And he said, look, the point is that 10 years ago, all of these big network backbones, the people who ran them all knew each other and they all talked to each other. And if something like this happened, they would be on the phone and within 5 minutes it would have been solved. As the network changes, as we see traffic shift to Google and Facebook, and the traffic shifts, a lot of their traffic doesn't actually happen on the internet. And a lot of these new companies like Cloudflare don't have relationships with the old backbone operators, yep. if you know what I mean. They're sort of the young upstarts showing them how it's done and generally pissing off a lot of the people who have been around for a long period of time. And so when Cloudflare went wrong, they didn't have the contacts in place to ring people up and say, can we get this fixed? Was sort of what he was suggesting. I think the real story is a bit grayer. But the point here is that Verizon isn't protecting its network using something like filtering at the edge or manners or up, and they haven't got RPKI. Seems likely that they should have. But as Dave also pointed out, he said a lot of the times in these networks, 80% of the network might have it, but 20% doesn't. Is this one of mm-hmm. these cases? So I suspect it's pretty gray. We shouldn't be too quick to point fingers here. At the end of the day, the situation only lasted for a few hours. Didn't last for long before people got right. it under control. I'm willing to bet pretty good money that AWS is right now sitting down with Verizon and having a very difficult chat about why the hell this happened and why aren't they got their yeah. network in order and how much of their network backbone are they going to cancel until it's fixed, sort of thing. Does that make sense?
The beatings will continue until morale approves, yes, I think.
Yeah, I think AWS has got the pull for sure. to do this, and potentially – you know, if you're Cloudflare and AWS and you suddenly say to Verizon, well, it's, you know, your network isn't the best, so we're going to not buy so much bandwidth from you. We'll go and give it to somebody else who's got a proper network. And that could have a positive effect for the
It rest will get results, yes.
I suspect so. But 1000 Eyes published a really good blog post about this. Cloudflare sort of took the high ground and proceeded to beat their chests about how it wasn't their fault and blah, blah, blah. I sort of thought it was a little unhelpful, useful information, lots of good stuff, but they did try to sort of paint a holier-than-thou picture, which I think was overdone. And Noxion, who's the BGP optimizer, put a blog post out there and said, look, you know, this is what we do. This is how it works. We're not responsible. You know, if people don't configure things properly, this is what happens at the end of the day. But apparently somebody made it. I saw a tweet fly by the other day. Unfortunately, I didn't capture it. The good news is that there's been a real kick up in RPKI ROA requests. So hopefully we're starting to see people start to implement RPKI, and you shouldn't be accepting routes from an AS that you shouldn't be accepting it from. And this should help that in the right. long term.
Yeah, it's at the very least, it's embarrassing for the folks involved, particularly Verizon. So maybe we will see more work on that end. We do have links to all these things. There's a lot of content if you want to digest it. Check out the show notes for episode 241.
Yeah, 5 links to all of them. Quite a lot. All the stories.
All right, a quick break to tell you about ThousandEyes. They help organizations deliver business critical service by providing performance visibility and actionable intelligence from every user over any network to every app, including Office 365 and Salesforce. They've got cloud agents, enterprise agents, and endpoint agents. They use these to gather unique insights on network behavior, topologies, and how they affect application performance. Intuitive visualizations break down complex performance issues across networks that you own and those that you don't to help you reduce troubleshooting time and precisely pinpoint root cause. With ThousandEyes, you can generate performance data through active monitoring techniques. You can correlate multiple layers of performance data from layer 7 to layer 3, from BGP routing and DNS to quickly identify problems. You can pinpoint the root cause of device faults, congestion, Wi-Fi quality, and more. You can share events, dashboards, metrics, and visualizations with vendors and customers so you can collaboratively resolve problems faster. There's a special offer for Packet Pushers listeners. You can get a free account at thousandeyes.com/packetpushers. And while you're there, you can grab yourself a snazzy ThousandEyes t-shirt. ThousandEyes, thrive in a connected world.
Mm-hmm. And that blog post that I talked about from Thousand Eyes is a good demonstration of how their platform can see BGP problems in the internet, and you would have been in a position to understand what was happening without having to sort of flail around going, why is the internet broken? No idea. So it's sort of a proof of how this
It's content marketing in its finest, in that it's sort of touting what Thousand Eyes can do, but it's also giving you some pretty useful information and insight on what happened. So that's a nice balance they strike.
Mm-hmm. It's got pretty pictures too. Like lots of charts. I'm always a big fan of
like those charts.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah, it's good.
All right, back to the news. Oracle is going to retire managed DNS services from Dyn, which Oracle acquired back in 2016. Oracle is encouraging Dyn customers to migrate to Oracle Cloud Infrastructure instead.
Now, not a big deal. Oracle acquired the Dyn DNS back in 2016. However, the problem here is that Oracle Cloud has a DNS service, and they're saying you have to migrate to that. They're not giving you a migration tool.
Right.
So it's like, sure, you can do it, but you've got to go and put in all the work and work it all out, blah, blah, blah. And a lot of the features that are in the Dyn DNS platform are not in the Oracle Cloud service. So there's rather than try and explain them to you, if you care, go and read up on the various posts around the world that sort of explain what's lacking. I think Oracle's sort of got a bit of a tin ear here. That is, they're not really listening to customers. They're just doing what suits them and saying like, oh, bugger it, I don't want to run this anymore. I want to get rid of it. So they've just sort of shut it down and said, ah, oh, too bad. And screw you, customer. So I think it's a bit poor on their part to produce, you know, say, here's our Oracle Cloud, which they're running around and promoting it, you know, with mm-hmm. enormous effort, and then not come up with something that operates at parity with Dyn DNS. And I imagine most customers will be exiting out the door. The ones that want those features will have to go and find an alternative. And there are plenty
of options. That's the thing. When you're not making an easy migration path for customers, that's an opportunity for them to go look at a competitive service. And there are plenty out mm-hmm. there. So yeah, this is, I think, a tin-eared response from Oracle and how they've handled this. Although,
flip side is, maybe Oracle doesn't want those customers. Right? It's very possible that Oracle, you know, if you're not a $100 million spending, you know, $1 million to $10 million with them a year, they might not want you because you just don't make a difference.
Could be. Anyway, there's links if you want to go find out the details. The wireless LAN vendor Mist Systems, which was recently acquired by Juniper, has announced new products and a new approach to tech support. The company is releasing its first 802.11ax AP. This is the AP43. It includes all the 11ax goodness, including OFDMA and BSS coloring to boost performance and higher client densities.
So when Juniper acquired Mist, did I not say this is the start of an SDN campus strategy?
I don't remember. So. Probably.
Oh,
you got to write it down.
I was so looking forward to – I was going to gloat about that. I think when they acquired the Wi-Fi, I pointed out at the time that the Juniper's return to the enterprise is picking up steam. And in this case, I see this very announcement – The lead of the announcement is about Wi-Fi 6 APs, but that's a bit like, oh, nice. But so what I think is more interesting is that Juniper's Mist division is actually getting a dose of SDN campus, and the whole product line is getting up in a nasty rash. What is interesting is that they're using a tunneling network, which is based on L2 TPv3, which is an MPLS version. Not surprising. Juniper's love of MPLS is almost legendary. They talk about it being software controller badged AI driven. I've got no idea what badged means, but it uses a microservice cloud architecture and insight into the user experience. So you've got analytics, they've got a cloud platform. They're using AI to do a lot of the stuff in there. It's not controlling switches yet, but you read between the lines here and you'll get into where you want to be. I think there's a little part of me that says an overlay network using L2 TPv3 is a bit kind of weird. But then again, Cisco's using Lisp and they're both like open mm-hmm. standards, but effectively they're proprietary because they're the only companies that are using
it. Right. Okay.
Like, why not just use EVPN? You know? It's just,
I don't know. And what you're referencing is what they're calling Mist Edge. This is a hardware appliance that you can put on the campus or on premises for if you've got some kind of wireless network design where you don't want to have to shunt things back to their cloud system. You can do it locally, but they're insisting it's not a controller. But maybe, yes, they will add other capabilities and services to it to get that SD campus rollout.
Yes. Configuration of the tunnels is also simplified through the power of the Mist Cloud and its zero touch provisioning. Mm. The power of the Mist Cloud. Boy, you know, it's 2019 and customers just don't want anything that doesn't come from the cloud, apparently. No, it's pretty good. Pretty good. Can I get snarky?
You never have to ask.
So in one part of the announcement, there was this, I fair dinkum, I think somebody got a 44-gallon drum of really crappy marketing words and then just tipped them into a page and just got. So here we go. I'm going to read this out to you and tell me at the end of this what you think this is. We are excited to augment our world-class platform with these Change the Game enhancements and are committed to delivering a new innovation that brings much-needed simplicity, scale, and insight to the AI-driven enterprise.
No idea.
No idea. Toilet paper in the executive toilets, perhaps? That was in the middle of the missed announcement. It was classic. I just went, wow, fantastic. The
marketing department earning their money
right
there.
It's going to be great. It's great. Oh, that's there. Somebody, you just got to wonder if that's like in every marketing announcement that person's ever written, because it's just, that's just beautiful prose and you could put it in anything.
That's true. You could apply it to anything and it would.
Augment, world-class platform, Change the Game enhancements.
I swear, you know those refrigerator magnets that have words and you can just throw them up on your fridge to make funny sentences? I swear that's what they do. It's they've got a random.
I tweeted that out and somebody said minus 2 points for not including the word visionary. I thought, fair call.
I always got to have market leading in there, otherwise,
Market leading and visionary, but you know.
One other thing from this announcement that caught my eye: the company says it's going to ditch its tier one and tier two support in favor of its AI-based analytics. It's essentially an automated analytics system. It's supposed to do some predictive analytics and troubleshooting to help you resolve wireless problems. Ooh. If the automated system can't do it, then you have to raise a ticket with their TAC. You will get directly connected to what they say is a tier three engineer.
Oh, that's nice. I'm a big fan of that because quite often the tier one and tier two is outsourced. There was a vendor the other day who was out advertising that all of their tech support is in-house, no outsourcing, which I thought was I'd actually pay for that. That's a key value.
Tech support as a market differentiator makes a lot of sense to me. And if what I like about it is we hear so much garbage about AI and ML that it sounds like they're really actually putting something on the line here saying if our ML system can't handle it, then we're going to have to pull an engineer who's doing something important to come and talk to you.
Or somebody who really knows what they're doing. In fact, what they're actually saying is we're going to put you straight to the most expensive tech support because our AI is, I like that too. That's really cool.
I think that's a lesson more companies can.
I'll sit for all my cynicism. I might sit up and take a bit more notice.
How about that?
Because they're putting.
You have warmed the cockles of Greg's heart there. That's impressive. You've penetrated the cynicism.
Just the marketing. I'm inspired. Inspired cynicism. Inspirational cynicism. That's the thing.
All right, moving on. AWS has announced a new traffic mirroring capability in its VPCs. It's essentially a virtual tap. You can send packets to third-party tools for security inspection, monitoring, compliance, etc. You can capture all the packets in a VPC or filter for a subset, and then you send them to a target destination still in AWS, like a network load balancer, and then you run them through third-party apps in the AWS cloud.
There's a virtual spittoon filling up with tears from a small number of Silicon Valley startups right now.
Yes, yes.
This is a feature of certain startups that have been targeting the traffic mirroring or the packet capture so that you can send it back. And effectively, they've just been Sherlocked by this. This was always going to be, as AWS starts to listen to enterprises more and more and they see enterprises as the growth, they're going to start implementing these features. So in effect, VPC traffic mirroring is a spam port. Or a tap that you just put in the network and it captures all the traffic and sends it over to you. More importantly, it also allows you to filter the traffic as well. So it's not just, capture, send it, whack it out to what it, point it to your favorite tool so that you can collect it somewhere and pretend that you've got a team of experts analyzing it for security threats and intrusion and, whatever. This is actually a fairly comprehensive take. It's not the usual AWS, we'll do the bare minimum and do the rest, in 6 months or a year. This seems to be fairly comprehensive at the traffic.
Not only that, they lined up 15, partners, other vendors like Big Switch, Gigamon, ExtraHop, CPAC, and others who do packet analysis and packet collection to also simultaneously put out releases saying, yes, we're partnering here. We've got an application in AWS that you can use for this. So, they're serious about it.
It's a good idea because those tools, capturing the packets is absolutely key to taking to the value. Capturing the packets isn't actually where the value is. It's the analysis and the security and the threat intelligence that you get from the capture packets that makes it worthwhile.
The question is whether AWS decides that they can also sell you a service doing that packet analysis. So watch out. Big Switch, Gigamon, et cetera. All right, moving on. The Register has a pretty interesting story about a UK company that provides a ransomware recovery service for companies that are hit by encryption blackmail. This company is called Red Mosquito. Apparently what they do is negotiate with the attacker to lower the price for the decryption keys and then mark up the service to the customer.
I love this. I mean, the really, if you've got being ransomed and you hire a consultant, you're hiring them to get the job done. If they pay the ransomware people, so what? Is kind of what I want to say. And as long as they're expert in negotiating with these people, then what does it matter? And the register post was sort of getting a bit iffy and getting all bloviated about the fact that these people were making money off other people's distress. But if you've ever walked into somebody's data center and seen them in distress and you're the consultant hired to help them, it's the same thing. I'm kind of a bit, boo-rah for the company for just negotiating with the hijackers. But on the other hand, it's kind
of
necessary.
I think part of the issue that the register raised is that this company may not actually have let the customers know how it's doing it. It's just sort of like, hey, we got your files decrypted. Here you go. Necessarily letting them know how they're going about it, in that they don't have this magic tool to decrypt your software. They're just negotiating on your behalf, and you didn't really know that. So that's a little...
Yeah, if they're sort of pretending that they're cracking it open or something like that, then yeah.
So, but that's the issue. Is there any kind of misrepresentation here? And the register did talk at length to a lawyer about whether this, were they somehow engaged in a criminal activity? I don't think so, but it's a funny story.
Yeah. I used to always say, when I would talk to the managers in various companies I worked for, they'd say, it's all about getting the job done, not about the style that you get it done with. And they would always laugh and then go, yes.
That's right.
So, I think people sort of, there's a lot of, people want to save face and say they've done it the tough way or the hard way. And you just go like, well, why didn't you just do this and get it done? But I did feel that was a little bit weird. I think the interesting thing here is that we've seen two companies in Florida this week, two government organizations. I think they're like town councils or city councils there. They each have paid something in the order of $400,000 to $600,000 each to unlock the ransomware in their systems after they got owned. So I think you're going to see a lot more of this ransomware because it actually seems to be making real money, like $1 million US in two cases of affecting a US government organization. That's a lot of motivation.
Yeah, and we talked about a ransomware case last week. It turns out it was a township or a city council or something that paid out. They got an insurance provider to cover this. So apparently you can get insurance for this as well, which means it's going to be even more lucrative if they can just write it off on insurance. Watch out. For our last story, Greg, I guess you have a marketing banana award to hand out.
Well, actually, so far in this episode of The Network Break, we might have more marketing bananas. But this week, I discovered the Microtik Cloud Router Switch. That's all one word, Cloud Router Switch.
Which is it?
Couldn't you make up your name, what to call it? Is it not a router? Is it not a switch? But you also don't want to miss the opportunity to say cloud, so you put them all together and say the Microtik Cloud Router Switch, which I think is deeply amusing.
Yes, well, there you go. I don't know. But that paragraph you read from Mist, my banana might have to go to that one.
All right. Okay. We'll have to start a spreadsheet and start putting marketing banana awards and actually run that all year and have a show.
Yeah, I think so. The golden banana. I like it.
Cloud Router Switch. Just like... jumble it all up and go with it.
List.
That'll do. Yeah. I can see the executive board. What are we going to call this? We're going to call it the Cloud Router Switch because I want to go to the bar. Let me out. <It's> like, done.
That's right. At least they didn't say market leading.
All
right. Well, that wraps up our news analysis. Please stay tuned to hear Ethan Banks and I in conversation with Anuta Networks about its network automation platform. That's coming right up. Hello, you're listening to Tech Bytes from the Packet Pushers. This episode is sponsored by Anuta Networks. Anuta makes network automation software for multi-vendor environments. In this episode, we hear from Kiran Sarupa. He is Director of Marketing at Anuta, and he introduces us to Anuta Atom, the software platform that drives Anuta's automation solution. Kiran explains Atom's capabilities, including low-code automation, network device configurations, compliance checks, telemetry collection, and more. You'll also hear questions and comments from Ethan Banks and me, Drew Conway Murray, of the Packet Pushers. Note that this Tech Byte is the first 15 minutes or so of a longer webinar from Anuta, which was part of the Packet Pushers Virtual Design Clinic, and that took place in June of 2019. You can see that full presentation on the Packet Pushers YouTube channel. That presentation includes slides, customer case studies, and a demo. And if you like what you hear from Anuta, you can go to anutanetworks.com/packetpushers for more information and the chance to snag a free polo shirt. Now, here's the Tech Byte.
So we all know the networking is complex, and it's getting very complex with trends such as 5G, IoT, and edge computing. Networking is going to be even more critical. But when you look at the network automation landscape, the operators have a daunting challenge. They have to have expertise in config management, compliance enforcement, software upgrades. They need to have expertise on designing the policy and troubleshooting. And all the while, they have a lot of constraints. They have to reduce the OPEX. They have to deal with multi-vendor infrastructure. There's a lot of brownfield deployment, and there are a lot of existing scripts that need the care and feeding. And not to forget, there is a trend towards hybrid multi-cloud. So the management is always looking at standardization and automation. When you look at the tools that are available, as you can see, there are many tools. There are tools for documentation, there are tools for provisioning, there are tools for analytics, and there are tools for remediation. But what is happening is your information is stuck in islands of databases, and there is no cohesive way to look at the entire infrastructure as one unit. There is an urgent need to have a comprehensive solution that delivers documentation, provisioning, analytics, and of course, troubleshooting. So let me introduce you, Anuta Atom. Anuta Atom is a comprehensive network automation solution. It is a software-only solution, but it works with multi-vendor infrastructure. It helps all the way from onboarding the new devices, configuring the various day zero policies on those devices. It helps with software image upgrades, and it introduces a self-service capability. So from a simple GUI, you can push configurations to hundreds of devices. It also collects analytics using either streaming telemetry or the traditional SNMP. And using the concept of closed loop automation, it helps achieve the compliance with your infrastructure. We will go into more details of each and every feature of the Atom that we highlight here.
So quick question, Kieran. You mentioned closed loop automation, and you've got it on this slide here as well. Does that mean intent-based networking? Sometimes those two terms go hand in hand.
Yes, intent-based is probably a superset of the closed-loop automation. What we are doing is we are identifying the day-to-day operations, the runbooks, the troubleshooting that happens in a day-to-day scenario, and we created a framework. So for example, let's say you push a config onto the router to configure a QoS policy. How can you guarantee that the same quality is currently available on that network? You have to, of course, issue a bunch of show commands, and you look at the output, and then you take some corrective action. You push more commands to the device, right? So this sort of activity, we are bringing automation to it. So the Atom itself will go provision config, checks the statistics using analytics, and if it detects any deviation, it goes and refines its policy and pushes the config back onto the device. That's the concept we are going towards. It's true, it's on the way to the intent-based networking, but I like to think this is something which you can use today with your existing brownfield deployments, Ethan. So I want to highlight that, you know, Atom has been in production in large customers for a long time. We have been in business for more than 8 years, and large enterprises, large service providers have deployed Atom. I will go into a couple of case studies later as well. We have automated 45 different vendor equipment across multiple domains, including data center networks, branch networks, campus, SD-WAN, MPLS backbone network, etc. So let's go into the various features of Atom. The first feature I would like to introduce is the low-code automation with workflow. We understand defining a policy can be daunting. So we introduced a graphical designer using which you can drag and drop various decision logic modules onto a canvas. It's almost similar to a Visio diagram. We have many out-of-the-box workflows, but we understand it cannot match exactly what you have in your enterprise. So this workflow can be customized. For example, you may say, okay, as part of executing this command, I want to open a ticket in the service now, and only when it's approved, I will go issue the command. So you can mimic such kind of behavior into our graphical design. So this is very powerful. You can have a simple policy such as pushing ACL rule to thousands of firewalls, or it could be a very complex policy like software image upgrades, which requires many pre-checks, post-checks, etc. And this workflow engine can also be triggered by the analytics module. So if the Atom detects some deviation happening on the network, it will automatically trigger a workflow. And that workflow, as I said, can execute either commands to the devices like CLI or netconf commands, or it can even call APIs, or if the device supports a Yang model, it'll execute the Yang model as well.
Workflow engine, graphical user interface, low code. I think that's a big piece to focus on for a moment here. You're saying I don't have to be a programmer in order to automate, because what you are giving me is a graphical tool that I can build automation workflows with. Now, I know we're going to see this a little bit later on, but the big idea here is with the UI, I can create this workflow that's going to accomplish tasks for me on the network, configuration tasks, as the case may be, but it also will interact with other systems I have. Is that the point you're making?
Yes, that is correct. If you want us to get IP address from, let's say, Infoblox IPAM, if you want us to, you know, read the syslog notifications for a particular string, all of those things is the ecosystem that we are providing as part of Atom. We have integrations with 45 different vendors. They are not just the networking up devices, but also ITSM tools like ServiceNow, IPAM like Infoblox, and you will see later that it's a very comprehensive list, Ethan.
And Kieran, my question is around your ability to interact with devices to pull configure information out of them or interact with them. It looks like I see a list across the bottom, Telnet, SSH, API, and so on. So these are the mechanisms you're using to either pull information or push information to these devices.
Yeah, that is correct, Drew. We are on the management plane. We are not in the data plane. So that means we can issue show commands. We can read SNMP statistics. We can subscribe to any other API calls from these devices. So that's the low-code automation. This is where you define the policy. Now, once you define the policy and the Atom pushes the configuration to the devices, we need to ensure the policy stays intact. That's where the compliance feature comes in. See, Atom is constantly reconciling the policy with the device configuration. If someone goes and manually edits a configuration, Atom can detect it and say that device is now out of compliance. We also have service level compliance feature. For example, let's say you deleted a WIP, but you forgot to delete the ACL on the firewall rule. Atom can detect it and say, hey, this service is now out of compliance. And we can also automate some of the day-to-day tasks. For example, let's say you want to change the SNMP community string, you can do that. Or you want to query the infrastructure and say, show me all the devices where VLAN 500 is configured. Or you can say, do not allow any weak passwords on any of my vendor devices, whether it's a Cisco router, a Juniper firewall, or FI load balancer. You can enforce password complexity across multi-vendor infrastructure. Like that, there are many use cases where our customers have taken advantage of this compliance feature.
And so does a customer have to essentially build or configure these policies into your system?
Yes. So we will show you in the demo as well. The auto reconciliation feature comes by default. You don't have to configure anything. If someone manually changes, it will automatically detect it. But these kind of rules where you want weak password or no SNMP v2, those things you will have to configure in our system. But it's vendor neutral, so it is fairly easy to express the policy.
You have there on the bottom left 45 vendors. Now, I've seen some folks make the claim that, oh, we support all these vendors. And what they mean is they support all the different languages of iOS within the Cisco world. So it's kind of like, you know, they're stretching it a little bit. How do you mean 45 plus vendors?
Yeah, so it is actually like Cisco is one vendor, and inside that vendor, you could have iOS XR, Catalyst switches, or you can have API-based like Firepower or, you know, ACI. We have integration with multiple platforms, but it is considered as one vendor, Cisco. So like that, we have 45 different vendors. If you are counting the platforms like iOS XR separately, we have 150 plus platforms.
You know, you mentioned I can set a standard for how I want NTP to behave, and I don't have to be code specific. So you're abstracting like the command details away from me?
That is correct, Ethan. Once a device is onboarded into our system, a router looks the same, whether it's a Juniper router or a Cisco router or, you know, Fortinet firewall. It doesn't matter. All of the devices will look the same. So your policy will be at the abstract level.
Okay, so I'm really building policies and workflows, and I don't have to think too much about CLI stuff unless I want to.
Yeah, like I said earlier, the workflow is there, so you can actually issue CLI commands if you really want to as well. So we try to avoid that, but at the same time, we have the flexibility to issue commands to the devices as well.
And I just noticed it says multi-cloud there, and you've got GCP, AWS, Azure listed. What does that mean? This is network provisioning if I have workloads deployed in the cloud too?
Yeah, so for example, we can configure the backend connectivity between your on-prem VPN device and the VPN gateway in the AWS cloud, right? So we can help configure interconnectivity and the network plumbing between your data center and the public cloud. In future, short future, we can also automate the workloads inside the AWS, like configuring the load balancers. Let's say you get a Palo Alto virtual firewall in your AWS, we'll be able to maintain the lifecycle of that firewall. So that way, you configure the firewall policy once, it will push to the Palo Alto firewall on-prem, but it will also push the policy to the Palo Alto firewall in the public cloud as well. I also want to highlight that Atom is built based on Kubernetes and Docker containers, so it can be deployed in public cloud as well. So you can have an instance of Atom deployed in AWS cloud, Google cloud, or Azure cloud at this moment.
If I'm not running Kubernetes or Docker myself in my environment, do I have to be concerned about that?
No. So we have a packaged Kubernetes in the product. So with simple one click of an installation, first we will install the Kubernetes, then the Atom Docker will be installed inside that Kubernetes. So you don't really need to know what Kubernetes or how to install it. But I'm just highlighting that, you know, as the trend towards multi-cloud is coming up, Atom is built with microservices from the ground up. So the third benefit, after we provision the service, we are constantly collecting the data from the infrastructure. It could be your traditional SNMP data or the modern streaming telemetry. And Atom can collect all this data. So it can be a SNMP collector, streaming telemetry collector. It can subscribe to syslog messages. But if you want us, we can also read through any existing syslog servers like the Splunk, for example. So it can be a NetFlow collector as well. And it consolidates all of this data and publishes them to Kafka topics. So if you have any external applications, they can read the summarized information. And everything is stored in a time series database. We support the open source Prometheus database, the Influx database, or if you have a specific time series database, we can work with that as well. And we package the Grafana as part of our product. So you can build various custom dashboards, reports. You can also create threshold-based email alerts, etc. So Atom has a really modern software stack when it comes to telemetry. We will share one case study where one of the financial services provider was able to achieve the full streaming telemetry in their network.
You've been listening to Tech Bytes from the Packet Pushers with sponsor Anuta Networks. You can get more details about Anuta at anutanetworks.com/packetpushers, and Anuta is spelled A-N-U-T-A. The first 30 people to register can get a free polo shirt, and check it out. It's actually a nice looking shirt. And don't forget, you can find the full Anuta presentation, including customer case studies and a demo, on our YouTube channel. Just hit youtube.com and search for Packet Pushers. And speaking of Packet Pushers, you can find this and many more fine, free technical podcasts, along with our community blog at packetpushers.net. Follow us on Twitter at Packet Pushers, find us on LinkedIn, and rate us on Apple Podcasts. And last but not least, remember that too much networking would never be enough.